and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. Thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Amit Goswami. And we're going to talk about, many things. We're not going to talk about one of his books. We're going to talk about all of his books and his new CD that he has out and all the things that he has to say today. How are you, Dr. Goswami?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming on, and thank goodness we're not going to have all those technical difficulties we had the last time you were on.
It's always a pleasure coming on your show, Eva.
Thank you. So tell us, first of all, just for those people who are just becoming familiar with you, who you are and what you do and where people can find you.
I'm a quantum physicist. Actually, I'm also a quantum activist. I use quantum physics to change myself and hopefully make a dent in the ways that the world is operating right now, which needs a lot of change. We have crisis. We need to solve the crisis. We have a paradigm that is not working. We have to change the paradigm. So those are the stuff that I do. And you can reach me at my website, which is Amit Goswami. One word, AmitGoswami.org. And hope to hear from you more.
So tell us about your new CD that you have out.
Well, the CD is about it's a documentary about my work. It's about what quantum activism is all about. It's called The Quantum Activist. And really, it's really an introduction to the new paradigm of science that is developing that is the way out of the crisis that we've created, crisis of confidence in our science, in our worldviews, in the way we look at ourselves and how limited we have become because we are following this worldview. And all that is explained simply and with creativity by, well, I've said the words, but really the movie is the creation of two people, two women, Ree Stewart and Renee Slade, who have been super, very creative in the way that they have presented my work. I mean, I'm so pleased with it. You know, when I first watched it at Seattle at the opening, I was amazed. I started feeling enthusiastic about all this myself, which surprised me, you know. So
I have to say I felt the same way when I watched it. You know, I believe as you do, but being able to watch it and see it and hear someone else say it, that has credentials behind their names, that's not just out there talking, made me enthusiastic as well.
Oh,
thank
great.
You. I just appreciate it. I'm grateful. Okay, so before we get started, as you know, linguistics is a big problem, so I'm going to ask this question first. What is consciousness?
I was just writing about creativity, you know. Just today, and I was writing that materialists make consciousness into a linguistic operational stuff. It has no consciousness in their view. It's just a word that we use to signify a language use. Namely, we have subjects and predicates in our language. For example, I suppose they would give examples of the Hopi language where there is no subject and object, it's only verb. And that way, we don't need to assume that there is any consciousness. But this is such a warped view. You know, we don't have to really quibble about all this today. Today, we are in a situation where we can experimentally verify the worldview. One worldview is, of course, a materialist worldview, which everybody knows, scientific materialism. Everything is matter and manifestation of material interactions. Now, this is the thing. Material interactions come with some properties. One property is that all interactions, all communications use signals going through space and time. This is one. And the another property is that all material interactions are continuous. So phenomena have to be continuous, according to scientific materialism. Now, here is the thing. The work that we are doing, quantum physicists, suggests that we cannot understand quantum physics without introducing consciousness in it, without introducing not only consciousness, but a causally potent consciousness. Because quantum physics says that objects are possibilities. And then how do possibilities become actual events when an observer looks at these possibilities? Because observer never sees possibilities, observer sees actualities. So how does observers looking convert possibility into actuality? This becomes complex because John von Neumann, a very, very famous scientist, proved that mathematically, it's a theorem of mathematics, that material interactions can only convert possibility into other possibilities, never actuality. So consciousness must have a non-material component, and to make a long story short, the only paradox-free interpretation you can give is to suggest that consciousness is the ground of all being, and material possibilities of consciousness itself. Since consciousness is choosing from itself, it does not require any signal. In other words, the new view, this causation, this new kind of causation, is signal-less communication, which we call technically as non-local. So now you have an experimental verifiable consequence. Material interactions are always what we say local, require signals, and this new interaction, consciousness interacting with the world, requires no signal, non-local communication. So what does experiments say? Experiments since 1982 are saying that there are indeed non-local interactions in the world. So materialism is ruled out experimentally, scientific materialism. Instead, we have experimentally established the idea that new kinds of interaction exist in the world, new kind of ability of communication. We call it downward causation, and this is a causal ability of consciousness. As we choose from quantum possibilities the actual experience that we have.
Now, do we choose this in the moment, or is what's happening at this moment something that we created 2 years ago or whatever?
Well, we have a tendency of being conditioned. So this is the problem of being human. We have a perceptual apparatus called the brain, which makes memory, and when these memories interfere with our seeing things with our perception, then indeed past responses influence our present response. So to be creative is a challenge. Challenge in the sense that we have to bring in that immediacy, bring in that urgency of seeing, bringing that without that urgency, the mind has a tendency of succumbing to the brain's memories and only see through the brain's memories. So creativity, in other words, is not easy. It requires a preparation, a process that includes preparation, then some unconscious processing, what you call unconscious processing, and then creative insight. Then discontinuous thoughts come to us. But ordinarily, thoughts will be just thoughts of memory.
So if we want to change our life today so that it's different tomorrow, can we do that?
Yes, we can do that. But as I said, it requires creativity. It requires the ability to respond without sifting through the mirror of past memory.
Okay. So does that require cohesiveness of I don't know what word to use.
Intention. It requires cohesiveness of intention. It requires a purposiveness. We have to really wake up to the fact that we are not random human beings responding to chance events in the world. We are actually a purposive consciousness, and the universe has a purpose. It evolves and evolves in order to make better and better representation. So what we really covet, like things like love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness, that Plato called archetypes. When we wake up to this purposiveness, we get a focus. Without this, without tuning to the purposiveness of the universe, it all seems meaningless, and then we become hedonistic. Then we become involved with just looking things that are pleasurable, avoiding things that are painful, and life in just with just ordinary dreams like the so-called American dream. You know, a big house and a big car, and that's it. We are satisfied. But the American dream really is the pursuit of happiness. We forget it today. It's the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Liberty ultimately includes creative freedom. Without freedom, liberty means nothing. If liberty is just liberty to take any flavor of ice cream that you like, that's a very small application of liberty. I can do without it. I don't mind eating chocolate ice cream every day. But really, joking aside, we have lost our touch with the necessity of creative freedom. Today it's coming back. We have crisis on our hands, so we need innovation. We need creativity to get us out of this situation, so people are talking about creativity again. What we need is not only talk about creativity, but talk about an entire paradigm shift. We got to get out of this very myopic materialist worldview.
So people say to me many times, how do you wake up to that? Tell me what button to push.
I wish it was just a button to push. That would be simple, wouldn't it?
It would.
Button pushing works only with material machines. We are human beings. Our creativity is latent only because we succumb to our conditioning. How to get out of conditioning? We have to go through an entire process. As I said, it requires preparation. It requires also waiting for things to gel in the unconscious, which we call unconscious processing. Then comes insight. But even when we get a discontinuous insight, a thought that never occurred before, even then, we have to manifest that insight into a product, and the product could be us, which, of course, is a tremendous accomplishment of transformation in the very way we sort out things in the world, to our perspective changes. So, you know, this kind of thing is not easy, but on the other hand, it's not difficult either.
So I'd like for you to talk about first of all, the ground of all being, what do you mean by that? Do you mean God or whatever somebody calls it?
Their technicalities aside, yeah, that's what I mean. Technicality meaning that God, I prefer, and most traditions do keep the word God in that sense. God means the creative agent of this ground of being. The ground of being, sort of philosophically speaking, has to be thought of as eternal. But anything that is eternal, non-changing, is outside of space and time. Nothing can happen. So for creativity to come into the picture, for things to happen, we need some limitations. So God is not exactly the entire ground of being, but God is the creative agent of the ground of being after some limitations have been established.
So what is ground of being if it's more than God?
Well, ground of being sometimes is called Godhead. It is the eternity. It's the eternity that is always there in the background. Sometimes people ask me, when I teach Big Bang Theory, what is before the Big Bang? And then
that
is going to
be my next question.
That is a good question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to answer it is that before the Big Bang is the eternity, which is always present. So this consciousness is the ground of being gives a good answer to that perpetual question. Otherwise, you could regress infinitely. What is before? What is before? What is before? But when you have eternity, the buck stops there because nothing can be before. It has no past, no present, no future. It's eternity. It contains all possibilities, everything that will ever be the case. Because everything is included, there is no time in it. But to get time into the picture, to get creativity into the picture, to get creation of the universe into the picture, we got to have limitations, such as we must have some laws of the universe, we must bring in meaning, we must bring in the idea that there are definite templates of biological being that we would work with. After all these limitations comes the creation of matter, because matter has to then make representations of what went before. Representation of mental meaning, representation of this blueprints of biological functions and all that.
So do you have a theory of how the original observer came to be?
Yeah, of course. Of course. The original observer is the one-celled creature from which we have all evolved. Some 4 billion years ago, 4.5 billion years ago, that took place. I mean, that was a monumental event. Before then, everything was just possibility. Of course, we cannot rule out that there aren't other planets where other such one-celled creatures have arisen. Within that caveat, I can say that indeed, before life appeared on the scene, everything was just quantum possibilities for consciousness to choose from. But there was no manifest consciousness, there was no manifest observer, and therefore no choice, and therefore things just remained possible things. We had a possible universe, so to speak, but no actuality. That moment of creation of that, what John Wheeler says, completion of the meaning circuit, completion of the life circuit in this case. In that point of occurrence, the whole universe, Big Bang included, is created going backwards in time.
Can you explain that? Because I don't quite understand going backwards in time.
Well, I mean, you have to think. It is very intriguing, but it's true. The life came about, as I said, 4.5 billion years ago. But the Big Bang, our latest calculations are showing, probably happened 13.5 billion years ago. So this creates a problem because, you know, at the Big Bang, on that heat, obviously life can never exist. So this is the way it has to be. And how is it? It must be that when consciousness chooses, then everything manifests, even if it is a delayed choice. So although the first living cell chose 4.5 billion years ago, all the things that went before that being, like a planet with atmosphere, like solar system, like galaxies, and Big Bang itself, has to be there in the whole causal lineage. And the entire causal lineage manifests right at that moment, but entire space and time is created with it. So time itself is created in that chronological way that logic says it has to happen. So our choice now precipitates the actuality from possibilities then, going backwards in time. That's what I mean by it.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about evolution and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
What did things evolve, or did things spontaneously appear, or was it both, a combination of both?
Yeah, well, this is a very, very good question. For a long time, you know, spiritual traditions, religions thought that there is no evolution because God is needed to create. It doesn't, you know, initially it didn't make sense to people, I suppose, that God cannot create instantly. I mean, this is the mistake we made in those days, because we didn't realize that the universe is lawful. So many things in the universe looked so accidental, so full of chance happenings, that we did not fathom that there could be laws of the universe, that God works within laws. So when science was established, we found laws. So naturally, scientists were very much interested in terms of, okay, what are the laws that operate, even for manifestation? There is no longer any need to assume that arbitrary things can happen. So naturally, the idea in Genesis that God created the world all at once, although I know there is a metaphorical interpretation how you can avoid that particular meaning, but still, mainly, people interpret it as saying that God created everything at once. But the evidence, scientific evidence, was collected, and it shows clearly the fossil record that there is evolution. There is simple fossils initially, single cells, and then multiple celled animals, and then invertebrate, vertebrate, and all that.
So what accounts for missing fossils?
That's what I'm getting at. So, okay. Of course, this theory that Darwin gave, that also has some big gaps called fossil gaps. The fossils that, according to Darwin's theory, should have been continuously laid out. They are not continuous. There are gaps in them. So what do the gap mean? This is where I have developed a new theory based on the worldview of that quantum physics is giving us, namely consciousness is the ground of being. In this view, you don't have to assume that the evolution arose from continuous mechanisms, chance mutation and natural selection from the mutation. We don't have to assume that. Instead, what we say is that, yes, there is evolution, but the evolution is evolution of consciousness. And when you look at from consciousness point of view, creativity is always there. There is the conditioned action, but there is also creative action. Now, when we become conditioned, things become continuous. Have you noticed our stream of consciousness is quite continuous? So, but it is creativity that is intermittently taking place, and that is what enables us to start new phases of life. Like, you know, almost everybody is aware today of midlife transitions. We change very quickly some of the periods. So biological evolution is the same way. There are some quick changes, instantaneous changes that take place, and that is what explains the fossil gaps.
So how, and I don't know really how to word this, how does the information and, I guess, intention come from the ground of all being into materialism? How does it get there? If
well,
not, is
this is the thing. What is the driving force? What you are asking is a very, very intelligent question. What is the driving purpose of the universe? I mean, why we just talked about creativity and evolution. You know, I have written a book on it, Creative Evolution. Why go through all that? Why, you know, why not stay in the unmanifest? In fact, this is a problem for some people. A problem for their thinking, because many people think that God is perfect, therefore the world should be perfect. So now why? And but here is the catch: evolution gives us the way out. Evolution says that evolution takes place in such a way that initially beings are not so perfect. You know, in the animal kingdom, there is a lot of what we consider as human beings, a lot of cruelty. Animals eat other animals. Well, human beings do too, but we are trying not to. We are trying to be vegetarian, right? I mean, that is also eating something, but we are not killing it. When we eat a vegetable, we don't kill the vegetable. There is a fundamental difference between a vegetarian and a meat eater. Meat eaters have to kill the animal from which you are drawing the meat. But anyway, that's taking us aside. So the idea of evolution is that we begin as imperfect beings, but we try to become perfect. This is why we do it. Why does God manifest? Why not stay in perfection forever? Because in the unmanifest, in the eternity, nothing happens. Why do things happen? Things happen because we want to get that perfection eventually, but in manifestation. So we say that there are these archetypes of value, love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness, being the five major archetypes that we can recognize. Can we be loving by just wishing it? Can we be just by wishing it? No, we have to struggle for it. We have to evolve toward it. So the idea of evolution is that, okay, initially we are not very loving. Initially we are not very perfect. But eventually we evolve towards being loving beings. We evolve towards perfection. We evolve toward justice. We evolve toward goodness. And you can see that we have evolved. In the 20th century itself, in the last century, major events took place that took us to a more just society. Of course, now we have a backlash, but,
I don't see that very much. I don't see that in our society.
I know. That's why I said that we have backlash. You know, we make progress. It's like proverbial monkey going up a bamboo pole. You know, you go up 1 foot and you fall 3 feet. It's something like that. But the taste of that just society remains with us. And eventually we catch up again. And when we catch up, we go a little bit more. So, you know, we fall 3 feet, but then we'll climb 4 feet. So it will be a net gain. And that's the way that we have always proceeded. So yeah. Don't be too disheartened, Eva. I mean,
I want to go back just a little bit and get you to explain delayed choice, because that's the first time I've heard that phrase. Delayed choice and anthropic principle. Not heard that before.
Well, you mentioned anthropic principle. That is a good example of delayed choice. Without delayed choice, the anthropic principle would be unexplained. Because the world does go towards establishing consciousness. That's the anthropic principle. World is designed in such a way that eventually consciousness will come about. But in quantum physics, we need consciousness to have a manifest world. So how does the world manifest then? Only when consciousness comes about, actually, when the circuit is complete. The world needs consciousness to manifest, and consciousness needs the conditions to be right so that consciousness can manifest. So this circularity is the circularity of behind the anthropic principle. We need the universe. The universe needs us. The universe cannot manifest without the observer. The observer cannot manifest without the universe and its evolution.
Now, how does this correlate with free will?
So free will is that ultimate causation that is beyond all material causation, the causation that we started with this whole dialogue. Remember I said quantum physics is the physics of possibility and consciousness is needed to choose from these possibilities. That choice, when made freely, without past conditioning, is what we call free will. We do have free will, but it is at a higher state of consciousness. It is at that consciousness that we call God.
Okay.
I call it quantum consciousness.
So in our everyday lives, let me rephrase this. The average individual walking around that is not conscious, and I know you know what I mean by that. That's not fully aware.
That is not particularly conscious because we are not really using the freedom of choice that we have in real consciousness. In other words, we live sort of a zombie-like existence where we are more or less conditioned beings, more or less machines. But the tricky word is more or less. I mean, it can be more. It's within our prerogative. For example, we can start saying no to conditioning.
Yes, correct. So people who say to me, yes, I have free will, I can go swimming today or I can go to the grocery store, is that free will?
No.
That's
it's not. It's
okay.
Not free will. We don't require free will to explain that. If materialist scientists have very good models of neural nets that, in their model, that's the brain, and these neural nets then are conditioned to move in various pathways. One pathway is for you to go to swim tomorrow, and another pathway is for you to go to an ice cream parlor instead.
Okay.
I mean, both will satisfy your desire to avoid heat, You know, ice cream is equally good, make you fat, but good. Swimming is better, makes you trim. But, you know, sometimes we do this, sometimes we do that according to our history of conditioning. That's the materialist model. It works. We don't need creativity of consciousness in order to choose between swimming and ice cream, right?
So, and I hate to be redundant here, and I know I'm doing that, but I'm going to do it anyway because people don't understand it. What is, to tell somebody, if you're giving a lecture to a whole audience that's not awake, what are the things in their lives that are free will that they cannot, so they can, you know, put a push pin on it and say, oh, that's what free will is?
Okay. This is a very, very, very good question. So one of my favorite examples is when you agonize over an ethical decision. Think about it. When you agonize about an ethical decision, sometimes these ethical decisions are so tricky. They require so much finesse. And choice becomes really an agony because it is not unambiguous. The ethical point is not unambiguous. For example, you know, I often have this debate with many well-meaning people. You know, because sometimes I like making radical statements. For example, I made a statement at a lecture saying that all conscious people don't believe in truth-telling in a trivial way. And people get very upset. Are you suggesting that people should lie if they become conscious? Because they have never encountered the ethical dilemma of choice that we sometimes face. For example, you see somebody run, and the next moment you see somebody following that person, obviously, and the person has a gun. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to say that if this person asks you, where did you see a person running, you don't immediately tell the person, oh, yeah, I saw he went that way. Instead, you hesitate and you say something that is neutral or otherwise because you don't want any person who is running to be killed. But, of course, if you realize that, well, this person with a gun is a policeman, then you might again change your mind and give it away. But that moment is a moment of creativity, moment of real choice, that you didn't succumb to your conditioning immediately, that the person of authority, if the person asks, in an authoritative voice, then you immediately obey. You didn't do that. You didn't succumb to that conditioned action. Instead, you held on. You said, okay, wait a minute. And that's the creative opening. That's the open for a creative decision. So in this kind of situation, it's very easy to see that we have causal efficacy and we have to bring it in manifestation. And we do. Most people are able to recognize that, yeah, in that case, we may have to tell a lie in order to save a person.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, let's talk about health. What role does being conscious play with your health in the manifestation of disease or sickness? Is it sick because your organ is sick, or is it sick because there's downward causation?
Going
all
right.
Sense?
Yes. This is also, all your questions are so wonderfully pertinent questions of our life and dilemmas of life that we suffer from. Again, we have the problem with materialist science because in materialist science, only allopathy, this culture of only the physical body, and allopathy is the treatment we have. It's also called modern medicine. Somebody got very upset recently with me because I used the word allopathy. But, you know, modern medicine means modern medicine. What is modern medicine? Every form of medicine that is being used is modern medicine. So I don't like that phrase. So I'll say allopathy. And allopathy is based on the idea that we only have physical body. Only the material body is the only thing that we got. So all disease must be because disease of an organ. But, you know, this is a fallacy not only of concept, but it is also a fallacy of what you actually see. Because, you know, there is now disease like chronic fatigue, where you make whatever test you make, you know, you test all the organs and all the organs are okay. Nothing wrong with any of the organs. And yet the person is constantly complaining of pain. So where does the pain come from? So even empirically, experimentally, this kind of attitude that only physical body is the only place where disease can come is wrong. It's just incomplete. So what other bodies do we have? In the new science, and also in old traditions, they knew, because they were not so tied up with the materialist prejudices that we have today in our science. In the new view, new science, consciousness has four compartments of possibility. We have four kinds of experiences. That's very easy to see. We have sensing. We sense the physical. We have feeling. What do we feel? We feel vital energies of a vital world. So that's another world of possibility. Then we think. We have mental facility, and that comes from participating in a mental world. And then finally, we even have an intuitive world, archetypal world, world of values that gives us intuition. That is a world that is so subtle that we can only intuit it. So fourfold experience, four different worlds. It's a multiverse, consciousness is. Consciousness and four different kinds of possibility. So in this view then, any of these worlds, and we have a body in each of these worlds, we have a physical body, we have a vital body, we have a mental body, supramental body. So any of these bodies can become diseased. Any of these bodies may not be working properly, or we are not accessing it properly. We are not moving it properly. We are not using it properly. So we have alternative systems of medicine, which actually have the idea that maybe when these bodies go awry, then also disease can come. And then the proof of that is that unless you remove the defect of these bodies, these more subtle bodies, as they are called, you are not going to remove the symptoms permanently. The symptoms will come back. And as you know, many of our chronic disease, and this is where allopathic medicine is completely helpless and hopeless, they only take care of symptoms. But the symptoms repeat, they come back. And then again, you have to take medicines. And you know what? These medicines, allopathic medicines, are very harmful to our body eventually. They are poisons, and they eventually get us into serious problems in other parts of the body. So in the name of healing, we are using killing medicines, literally. So the real answer to chronic disease is to go to vital body medicine, go to mind-body medicine, where mind and the vital will be treated to bring them into synchrony with the physical when pain will go away.
So let's talk about these alternative medicines. Are you talking about supplements? Or are you talking about frequency medicines, you know, electromagnetic?
Well, frequency is one name to this medicine. I would rather call them, you know, the new science we introduced, these bodies. I just mentioned them, physical body, material body, then vital body, mental body, supramental body. So I would rather call these medicinal systems vital body medicine, mind-body medicine, like that, instead of vibrational medicine or frequency medicine. You know, those are names when we did not have a very clear picture. I have written a book called The Quantum Doctor, where the picture is completely clarified between all alternative medicine practices and their relationship with conventional allopathic medicine. So now that we have a good theory, there is no need to use such very ambiguous notation as vibrational medicine or frequency medicine.
Yeah, they're not very good definitions, are they?
No. So vital body medicine, and those medicines are traditional Chinese medicine like acupuncture, Ayurvedic medicine, which uses herbs, mind-body medicine, I've already mentioned. Homeopathy is another one that is a vital body medicine also. Chakra medicine, that is also a vital body medicine.
So all of these medicines treat the etheric bodies?
That's another name for the vital body. It's sometimes called etheric body, yes.
Okay. And let me ask you this. When we close our eyes, is everything still there?
Well, as much as this may surprise people or jolt people, no, they are not there in manifestation. Unless somebody else is there and somebody else is looking at them, then they are manifest in that person's experience. But really, if nobody is there to look at in the current quantum view of the world, in the consciousness-based science point of view of the world, we really are supporting the saying that if a tree falls in the forest and there is nobody to hear it, there is no sound. There is no, there not even a tree, not even a falling.
What's the proof behind that, Amit?
Well, the idea
people
is
want
that
to know that. Quantum
physics is literally saying that everything is possibility. That does not mean that the possibility is possibility to anything. You know, possibilities can be fairly limited. So, for example, the moon is, we are not looking at the moon. Is the moon there? Well, we cannot look at the moon because it's on the other side. That is fine. But is it there? In quantum physics, we have to say that, no, moon is not even there. It's in possibility. But it so happens that the possibility is very, very compulsory, that it does appear as a bound object shaped like the moon, and it does appear pretty much at the place where we are predicting it. Because the flexibility of movement, the possible movements that the moon is entitled to, staying within the laws of physics, within the laws of quantum physics, that flexibility is minuscule for the moon. It's such a big object that it really has to appear as that moon pretty much at the place where we predict it to appear.
This
is very different than when you think of a thought, because thought, on the other hand, is a mental object, and for which quantum physics says that, well, it can be pull up quantum movement. So at the next moment, what you will think, you really cannot predict very well, can you? I mean, right now you are talking with me, but your mind may be thinking of food, which you probably need. You are hungry, right? Happens all the time.
Yeah, that's true. So, is what happens? Is quantum possibility in a wave, and when we look at it, it collapses into the picture that we see?
In the actual event that we see, correct. It's always possibility before the experience. Experiences, manifestation of the material world, manifestation of the mental, vital, everything, is only in our experience. They are not already manifest out there. There is no reality manifest out there or in here. There is no manifestation without conscious participation.
Okay. Does everybody see the same picture?
Only for the physical macro world. You look at the mental pictures, so we are thinking all the time, but two people think the same thought? Very rarely. Very rarely. We call it mental telepathy when that happens.
Okay, so if someone's looking at an apple, will everybody see the same kind of apple?
Yeah, the same kind of apple, because the movement, the possible movements of the apple are so inhibited. You know, the center of mass of the apple can move because of quantum uncertainty, but it can move only about 10 to the minus 16 centimeters or so. You know how minuscule that is? We can measure such minuscule movement, by the way. So you see an apple at a place, and I'm not seeing that same apple at the same place. It will be a little bit different. And laser instruments can measure that today. So we have verified that there is quantum movement. There are possibilities indeed, and they become manifest in our experience, and each of us experience the apple in slightly different places. But the difference is so minuscule that we cannot gauge the difference with naked eyes.
Okay.
So we think that we are seeing the same apple, and so we think that the apple must be outside of our consciousness. Apple must be because it's public.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a different kind of question now. Let's say that you have two people, and one person is sick in the head with mental disorder. And the thing that makes that person feel good is to be touched by another human being. I don't mean molested or anything like that. I just mean loving touch.
Loving touch, yes.
Well, is that real, or is it something the person's making up in their head, or is there something going on there?
In the new view, we value subtle objects. So if somebody hugging you is making you feel good, is that real? Yes, it is real, of course. It's a feeling that you have. What are you feeling? You are feeling the vital energy of this person. And if it is good vital energy, it will feel good. But, of course, you know, it's not uncommon experience that somebody hugs you and you don't feel so good. What does that mean? That means that this person's vital energy is not really so good. I have had that experience. It's amazing, you know?
Yeah, when people, traditional therapists try to say, oh, you need to learn how to just be alone and be happy by yourself. But sometimes people need love, and that love comes from a kind of energy exchange.
Absolutely, energy exchange. You can even hug a tree and feel love. In fact, hugging a tree often is a very good idea for lonely people. They should have trees to hug and animals to hug especially. And they're very good. They're good companions. Why? Because of their vital energy. I mean, a dog is not going to talk to you about nice things, but a dog is going to give you something even better, heart energy. So your heart will be activated. You will have expanded consciousness, which will have a loving relationship and acknowledgement to this dog's love. And this is why people have pets.
And this is not just an idea. There's science behind this, right?
Absolutely. Today we can do so much more, Eva. I was at a conference last year in Brazil, in a beautiful place, and there was an English researcher whose name I forget, but he presented some new data. Today we can measure the vital energy that is emanated from a person's heart chakra when the person is throwing loving energy.
Okay.
I mean, we can actually measure biophotons from this person's heart chakra with instruments that tell me that this heart chakra is open, whereas if heart chakra is not open, for example, a woman with breast cancer. In this theory, the breast cancer is due to heart chakra not being open. Can that be measured? Yes. The biophoton emission will be zilch. No biophoton emission will take place from such a heart chakra, which is closed off. The feelings are completely blocked. And this is the danger that women have when they grieve too much for a person and close their heart chakra.
So it's not necessarily some kind of codependency or something. It can
No. There is codependence, of course. It does transfer to psychology, but that's not all of it. There is also vital energy blocks.
Okay. That's what I just want to make sure that I wasn't the only one that thought that. You have a good enough sense of humor that you humor me and answer my question.
Well, I just don't take myself too seriously, so.
All right. We got about 10 minutes, and I want you to talk about what you want to talk about.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about quantum activism. So, you know, all these things that we talked about, subtle bodies, vital energies, free will, evolution, all these things tell us the most important part of it that it tells us is that quantum physics is giving us ideas to live by. For example, creativity is something that quantum physics talks about. It makes possible discontinuous events in our experience. Creativity occurs with a quantum leap, change that is discontinuous. We talked about it earlier. Non-locality, we have talked about it earlier. Non-locality is the signal-less communication. Mental telepathy is an example. So the one most wonderful thing that we learn is that if we know how to access this free will, this freedom to choose among possibilities, anything is possible. For example, we can choose health. We can choose to be loving. Anything is possible, provided, of course, we learn how to access this quantum consciousness and how to learn to use these quantum ideas, non-locality, discontinuity in our life.
I have a question here.
Excuse me?
I have a question. To be able to access this, do you need to be into low theta or high delta, or can you be in any one of those frequency ranges?
Well, it helps to be in a relaxed state some of the time. Actually, what I suggest is that one is in the beta mode some of the time, that's the do mode, and then one is in the V mode, alpha mode some of the time, or even delta mode some of the time, theta or delta mode in some of the time, that's the B mode. So this alternative do and be, you know my joke, do-be-do-be-do. if we live that way, then we become very creative. Then we are always in touch with our creativity. And this creativity is what enables us to transform, to change our worldview, to change our perspective of looking at things, psychological perspective, the perspective in terms of emotions, emotional perspective. In other words, it makes us intelligent in more than that IQ intelligence, which is only a very, very small part of our capacity of being intelligent. You know, Howard Gardner tells us that there are 7 kinds of intelligence. But of course, you know, we are so stuck with materialism that we only think of IQ intelligence as the only intelligence. No, we can be emotionally intelligent. We can be spiritually intelligent, which I call supramental intelligence. And those intelligences are much more important, although they are more difficult, of course, you know. But these are the things that if we learn, we can change ourselves and change the world. This is what quantum activism is all about. You know, old activism is change the world, but don't change yourself. The new activism is that change the world by changing yourself, through changing yourself, and having a social conscience. So not only you try to change yourself, you also make it easier for other people to process change. So we talk about changing politics, changing economics, changing our social systems, changing education, changing the relationship between science and religion, changing our healthcare system. Mm-hmm. All of this is part of quantum activism.
So now I have another. I said I was going to give you time to just talk, but that brings up another question. All of these people who get caught up in conspiracy theories and all that kind of stuff, you know, talking about it, studying about it, promoting it, are they doing more harm than good? Shouldn't they just be and mind their own life and learn peace in their own life, and then that'll take care of that problem?
I don't want to blanketly condemn a group of people, you know, because it's not big that people are paranoid about something. That doesn't mean that things didn't happen in that what the paranoid is imagining. We should always remember that. But having said that, one should also say that if you can, moving on is the best idea. It doesn't help very much dwelling on something with when the prospects are not very bright to find any results, even when looked upon from fairly long term. For example, I think people should give up conspiracy theories on the assassination of Kennedy. Time has come. I mean, that was a long time ago. We have looked at, and mm-hmm. have not found any evidence whatsoever for it. So now it's time to rest the case.
Doesn't it just feed negativity, though, when you constantly dwell on something negative?
Yeah, it is definitely a negative attitude towards life, and it is very counter to quantum. Quantum says be positive, be creative. Creative is to move on. Instead of staying with what could have happened, and if I discover it, then it's very important, it's going to change our life. It's not going to change our lives. The way to change our life is to be positive. Way to change our life is to balance the negative emotions from where such paranoid feelings come. Change the negative emotions with positive emotions, making brain circuits of positive emotions. Go and love somebody. Go and serve somebody. Go and be just somebody. Go and be good to somebody. Those things will create positive emotional brain circuits, and those brain circuits will come in handy when you get into the throes of some negativity, you know, and everybody does. You know, I get into the throes of negativity at least once a day, I'm sure.
No way, not you.
Yes, well, I'm only joking. It's more than once, I'm sorry to say. But, you know, the thing is that we have to have a sense of humor, which is the first positive emotion that you create in your brain. And then you say, okay, you know, there I go again. Then I have a negative emotion, and I was caught in it for more than a second, and that's unfortunate. I'm sorry. Let's move on. That's the attitude, right attitude in my book.
So you have started a movement called Quantum Activists. Tell us about that and tell us how people can get involved, because we've just got a few more minutes.
So people can get involved by going to my website, amitgoswami.org. People also can get involved by getting into the website quantumactivist.com. Quantumactivist.com.
And
so
what does
both of these websites
mean?
Will have information, articles, how to participate more, courses that we often organize in collaboration with various other groups who are into similar activities. It will have also lectures that I give on this subject, books that are being written, and, of course, this movie, great movie.
It is
we
a great movie.
You already mentioned it. Quantum
I loved
Activist
it.
Will give you an introduction to quantum activism.
It made me smile. It really did. So what kind of reception are you getting from around the world? Are people being receptive?
Yeah, people are very receptive. People are very kind, very excited. And, you know, I'm also writing a book which will come out. Hampton Dorps is bringing it out next winter, probably January. So look for it. It's called How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization. How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization. I mean it quite seriously. I mean, it really is necessary. We got to do this.
We are in trouble. We are.
Yeah, we are. We are.
We really are.
It's no laughing matter, actually.
People don't believe it, but we really are, and I think it's going.
No, people believe it. People believe it. A person who doesn't have a job today knows that we are in trouble. These economic turmoils are happening too frequently. You know, before the theory was that capitalism is basically okay, except once in a while we get into a bust. And that situation can last for a year and then it goes away. Unfortunately, now that is just not the case. We get a bust period, we get recession, and then, 3 years goes by and things will improve a little. But again, a recession. Again, a recession. The repeated recessions, that so frequent recessions that are taking place, for one reason or another, there will be some kind of bubble economy. There will be some kind of greed being displayed. There will be something or other that will go wrong. That is suggesting that we have something very basic that is wrong, which is our basic worldview, which has become too materialistic, devoid of spirituality, devoid of ethics, devoid of creativity. And this is why we are getting this crisis of confidence in economy, and not just economy, crisis of confidence everywhere.
Well, you know,
and
I read a book called Agape, The Antenna of the Soul, and I think if everybody would practice agape, then we could have instantaneous peace.
Absolutely. Agape, compassion, love, these are the basic stuff that you have to manifest. This is the objective of quantum activism as well. Yes.
Well, thank you, Dr. Goswami. I want you back, please, when your new book comes out, so I want to talk about it, too.
Of course, I would love to.
Take care, and thank you for coming on my show.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.